Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Thursday, March 6th. I'm Lisa Music reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, Eureka becomes a sanctuary city, final Vocality membership meeting Wednesday, and education by the people for the people. Brooke Thompson, author of I Love Salmon and Lamprey. Stay tuned. News on those stories and more coming right up. While the break in the weather today has allowed Caltrans workers to make headway on the closed portion of Highway 36 between Carlotta and Bridgeville, just east of Devil's Elbow, the roadway will remain closed overnight. We turn to our partners at Caltrans for the latest.
Good afternoon. My name is Manny Machado. I'm a public information officer for Caltrans District 1. As of late this afternoon, Route 36 remains fully closed east of Swimmer's Delight due to an active slide. Now, with the break in the weather today, crews were able to remove trees and debris from the roadway. Now, we hope to reopen Route 36 to one-way controlled traffic by early Friday afternoon, but motorists can expect delays of up to 1 hour. Now, this is subject to change. Motorists traveling to the valley and to Interstate 5 can use Route 299 as a detour.
Additionally, county workers are doing maintenance on Redwood House Road, the county road that connects with Highway 36 east of Carlotta and at Bridgeville. Traffic through the construction area will be reduced to a single lane controlled by flaggers. Up to 30-minute delays are anticipated between 8 a.m. and 6 p.m. today and Friday. The Humboldt County Roads Department urges motorists to slow down and use caution to keep our road workers safe. Eureka's Council has enthusiastically approved a resolution making the city a sanctuary city where police and other employees will refuse to assist with federal immigration enforcement. Daniel Mintz reports.
Finding that, quote, the recent presidential election has renewed a sense of uncertainty and fear among many communities in Eureka, the Eureka City Council has approved a sanctuary city resolution. The council emphatically supported the resolution, approving it unanimously at its March 4th meeting. As declared in the resolution, being a sanctuary city means no city funds or personnel, including police, will be used to, quote, investigate, interrogate, detain, detect, or arrest persons for civil immigration enforcement purposes. City Attorney Autumn Luna dealt with concerns about potential implications, such as loss of federal funding and punitive consequences, at the start of the hearing. She said the directives of executive orders and memos are being, quote, litigated, and, quote, there has been no judgment from any court that would prevent the city from taking the action today to approve the resolution. She told council members her office will be paying attention to court outcomes, but, quote, taking action today to approve this resolution is authorized. And she noted that the resolution, quote, shares a lot of commonalities with sanctuary policy of many, many other jurisdictions, including Arcata, the county, and the state. Many people spoke during a public comment period, most of them passionately supporting the resolution, including Brenda Perez of Centro del Pueblo.
It is time that we are equal in front of the law. It is time for the cities, for every institution that treats us as equals. We have the right to have the due process. We have the right to access attorneys. We have the rights protected by the Constitution, this Constitution that is being vulnerated at this moment by the highest level of the power of the United States. I will say that for the first time since I migrate here, I feel like we the people is real. We all, immigrants, citizens, documented and undocumented, we are all the same in front of a sanctuary status. This sanctuary status really, it made a difference. I'm witnessing that difference.
Several speakers told of their own family's experiences, including a man who said it's taken many years for a member of his family to gain legal status, quote, due to the hurdles and obstacles that this country has consistently thrown at undocumented immigrants. He described the sanctuary policy as, quote, a humanitarian responsibility. There was some strong commentary, including from those who compared federal immigration enforcement to Nazi pogroms, and an opponent of the resolution who said the only ones being protected by sanctuary policies are criminals.
Why you would want to support that small subset of the immigration population with a virtue signaling useless ordinance or whatever you're calling it. The thing about it is, these people are at no danger of deportation anyways. The only reason I could see that you would do this, considering the fact that we have a budget that's on the ropes anyways, and the feds are threatening to withhold federal funds to anyone that does a stupid move like this. Are you just doing it so that the funds get withheld and then you can blame Trump for our problems? It's kind of a dumb political move, if you ask me. So maybe you might want to rethink it. It won't have any effect on the ground as far as people being deported, because the only people they're talking about deporting are the people that have committed further crimes. And if you want to support them, then go to hell.
Other speakers said fear and anxiety over immigration enforcement is a mental health issue, with one suggesting that a forum on it be organized by the city. Council members said the sanctuary policy aligns with basic human rights standards. The most personal commentary was from Councilmember Renee Contreras Deloach, who related that members of her family came to America, were, quote, forcibly removed, and then returned when the political environment changed. She also told of her experience as a political leader in Utah in the early 2000s.
I remember, I represented a little tiny cluster, kind of like I do now, in a downtown area that was very, it was where the bulk of immigrants were at, and low income and Spanish speakers. And there was a raid that was conducted. There was no warning. Nobody knew anything about it. And of course, this was 2002 or 2003, I'm trying to recall. But anyway, once I heard what had happened, I immediately went to the homes of some of my neighbors to find out. I was worried. And when I got there, hesitantly opened the door. And, there's a room full of faces looking warily, right? Because some of them knew me, but others had no idea who I was. And it was a terrible day. And they had gone to a factory and just rounded people up. And it stuck with me. It happened, about 22 years ago, but it's just stuck with me. It's something that I'm never going to forget, is that there were children on porches sitting waiting for parents that didn't show up. And there were children at school who were waiting who didn't get picked up. I don't ever want to contribute in any way, shape, or form to something like that happening to anybody in our community.
Before the approval vote, Mayor Kim Burgell said she's, quote, so thankful and grateful to live in a place where we have this kind of love and connection with each other, and we value each other. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
KMUD is currently holding its spring membership drive with the theme Education by the People for the People. This week, KMUD News is highlighting this theme and those who put it into action here on the North Coast and beyond. Tonight, we feature Brooke M. Thompson, a Yurok and Karuk Native American who has recently authored a children's book inspired by the Klamath Dam removal and the effect it's had on salmon in the Klamath River. Thompson, who has a master's degree in environmental engineering from Stanford, fights for water and Native American rights through activism, public speaking, and academic research. Her children's book, I Love Salmon and Lampreys, is in part based on a harrowing event in 2002 when over 30,000 salmon died in a single day in the Klamath River due to low water levels caused by water diversion during a drought year. The event, which Thompson witnessed herself as a 7-year-old, is the biggest salmon kill in the history of the Western United States. Sagir Bjorn brings you the details.
Brooke M. Thompson is a Yurok and Karuk Native American who has recently authored a children's book inspired by the Klamath Dam removal and the effect it's had on salmon in the river. The book, Isle of Salmon and Lampreys, is in part based on a harrowing event in 2002 when well over 30,000 salmon died in a single day in the Klamath River. Due to low water levels caused by water diversion during a drought year. The event, which Thompson witnessed herself as a seven-year-old, is the biggest salmon kill in the history of the Western United States. KMUD's Lauren Schmidt spoke to Thompson about her book.
This book I have been working on since my freshman year of college in 2014, and I have gone through like several ideas about it, and I originally wanted it as part of a way to preserve some of the teachings from my grandfather, Iwok Archie Thompson, the last native speaker of the Iroquois language, as in he was the last person who was alive who grew up with it as his first language. And it's kind of evolved into what you see now. And one of the reasons it's, I guess, about me is because I feel like that's the only kind of story I can really tell at the end of the day is what I know. And I know my history with the Klamath Dam removal and being a part, seeing the 2002 fish kill where around 60,000 salmon died in September and witnessing that firsthand as someone whose family has been fishing on the rivers from time immemorial. For me, I wrote this specifically as a way for me to explain the situation to my cousins, to my younger cousins, and even those who are not born yet, what happened with the dam removal. So for me, it's important because this is a huge part of our history and a huge part of what all the Indigenous peoples who live in the area, like it's a large part of our win, our history and our struggle. And I feel like that's an essential thing for kids growing up in the area to understand. This loss of salmon is not just like this loss of like, oh, this fun activity we used to do for, you know, pastime in the family. It's this loss of culture. It's this loss of family connection. It's this loss of connection to my ancestors. I think also for me too, it's this understanding that growing up, it's not like I had a lot of books about current day, like Native American struggles. I feel like all the books I read that did happen to have Native Americans in it were mainly about like Native Americans a long time ago and in a pre-colonial era or like when colonialization was just happening. And so for me, it's also like kind of being like, hey, here's a book where there's a modern day native and modern day struggles and that this is a true story. This isn't something that could just happen. It's something that did happen. And that's a reason that we should protect the water so it doesn't happen again.
Isle of Salmon and Lampreys is illustrated by Ukrainian artist Anastasia Kamalevska.
It was important for the book to be watercolor since I'm talking about issues around the water. It felt like it was only appropriate that that's the medium that's used. I found her online and just really loved her artwork. And I was just like, really enjoyed looking at all her pictures. And I was like, I would love to have something in this style. And that in addition to the fact she's Ukrainian and there's a war going on in Ukraine and being like, I feel like this is, you know, maybe just a very small way I could be supportive and give her some more publicity.
When selecting a font for the book, Thompson was mindful of her own learning challenges.
The book has a special font that's easier for kids with dyslexia to read. And as someone who has pretty severe dyslexia, just having that ability to maybe get a kid who's having trouble reading just a tiny bit easier time with reading this book. I have had these learning disabilities and I've been in special education from third grade throughout high school. And that I feel like there was a bunch of times where it was just like told that I just wasn't going to do as much as other students and just to be kind of accepting of that. And knowing that, like, you know, this kid who was in special ed for years and years with dyslexia wrote a children's book and that that's possible and that, you know, we can make it in a way that's accessible for everyone.
Though the book is based on a tragic human-made event, it carries a hopeful message for children.
For me, like kids growing up right now, there's so much like eco-anxiety and this like stress about climate change and this future that they have to deal with, but don't necessarily have the political power to do anything about right now. And so I also just want something to give them hope in a time where it seems so frustrating. So I just want them to know that, you know, it's not hopeless and that we together are stronger and that there are things that people are doing that we can do to make change. And so, yeah, just that way to explain to my younger cousins what happened as an important tribal aspect, but also that understanding of hope in a time where it feels like so much media is surrounded around real world events where it feels hopeless at times for kids.
Thompson, who has a master's degree in environmental engineering from Stanford University, aspires to bring together water rights and Native American knowledge through engineering, public policy, and social action. You can find out more about her at brookmthompson.com, and her book is available in a variety of on and offline bookstores.
My favorite place that people can buy the book is heydaybooks.com. I also am hoping to get it at Booklegger and also the Eureka Bookshop. Otherwise, it's on a lot of major sites such as Amazon, Target, Barnes & Noble, independent bookstore, Pals. You know, check out your local bookstore first. If not, check Heyday. If not, you know, I won't be mad if you order from Amazon. I understand the communes. I just really appreciate anyone who takes the time to check out this book and know that I put a lot of love into it over these last 10 years. And I hope that that feeling of, you know, loss from the 2002 fish kill, but also that hope that I currently carry with me.
That was our KMUD membership drive special news spotlight featuring Brooke M. Thompson. We will air that interview in full on Tuesday, March 18th at 5:30 p.m. In the wake of the economic crisis in the Emerald Region from the collapse of the marijuana market, Vocality Credit Union began feeling so much pressure that it has determined to merge with another Northern California community credit union. Vocality members have been sent ballots, and on the day of the election deadline, Vocality will hold a final meeting with its members on this topic. Kelly Lincoln brings us more.
Vocality will be holding a meeting at the Mateel next Wednesday, March 12th. On December 18th, they held a preliminary meeting with the membership to advise them why the merger is needed and why they intentionally chose Community First. At that meeting in December, Vocality's CEO, Pat Neighbors, explained Southern Humboldt's credit union has been taking on water in the wake of the crash brought on by legalization.
We're having trouble because we have members who are having trouble making their payments. The credit union makes the vast majority of this money from the loan interest, from the loans we give our members. If members are unable to pay their loans, that means it's money the credit union does not receive.
Neighbors said that at that time, loan defaults had cost Vocality about $300,000.
We have been able to sell some of the foreclosures that we've taken on, some of them for substantial losses, and a few of them for is minimal gain. Right now, we're upside down, Tom, about $300,000 on ones we currently have. So that is continuing to happen. It has happened. We had foreclosures in 22. We had foreclosures in 23. And we have four pending, depending on how that rolls.
We are only so big, and we can only sustain so many losses.
Neighbors pushed back on rumors in the community, emphasizing that Vocality used good judgment when the loans were made, but the economy had changed.
Our members deserve those loans. Our members qualify for those loans. And unfortunately, our region is experiencing some really tough time right now.
This financial stress is compounded by changes in the regulations credit unions must follow, explains Scott Johnson, the CEO of Community First Credit Union.
And I think the other thing, and I think we're all feeling the effects of this without getting too technical, is there was a fairly significant change in accounting standards for how credit unions had to reserve for loans back in 2023. And that roiled everybody. And no one in the business was happy about that. But that's what the Financial Accounting Standards Board decided, and that's what we have to do now. But that change had a really big impact financially on a lot of credit unions. And if you weren't in a position where your safety and soundness could withstand that, that the results could be fairly significant.
Neighbors said these changes caused Vocality to have to increase its set-aside holding by $3 million.
Specifically because of the accounting process that Scott mentioned, with delinquency happening at the credit union and the accounting rules that changed, we had to tuck away over $3 million for potential losses happening, and we're seeing those.
One member in attendance summed up the nature of the choice for Vocality members like this.
So it's basically merge or die slowly. That's the choices.
I think that is
probably the best characterization for a lot of smaller credit unions across the country.
Vocality's board president, Marcia Mendel, explained why they had chosen Community First.
I was challenged on Facebook.
And the challenge was, you need to remember your roots. We do. And the best way to remember and honor those roots is to make sure this credit union is here for the future, for now and the future, for our kids, our grandkids, for all the people that we hope will move into Southern Humble and make it a place that it was. If we can merge with Community First, who I think is a perfect match for us, we're going to be ready for that. And we're going to be supporting it. And it will be a wonderful circle of financial and healthy growth. And that's why we're doing this. We talked to a lot of credit unions before we decided on Community First. And what our more goals were is our branches must stay open, our employees must have jobs, and our members must be served.
And some of those credit unions didn't really come up to mustard. This one does. They are us. And I wouldn't say that if I didn't believe it.
Board member Erica Boyd added,
right now, we have a choice. That's why we're doing it. If we wait, we don't have a choice, and it could close, or we could be merged with someone we have nothing in common with. You know, this way, these are people we want to be joined to.
Johnson told Vocality members they can feel confident the Garberville office will stay open after the merger.
We merged with another credit union, which was Mendeley Credit Union, back in 2017, which is where the Fort Bragg branch came from. And the Fort Bragg branch is still operating as strong and as healthily as the day that we took it over. And we had absolutely no plans to close that branch. And we had absolutely no plans to close the branch of Garberville either. We are very, very invested in local branches, and that is not going to change.
Neighbors added there will be better services for Vocality customers as well.
We looked for fit and finish, okay? And because of that, they fit so many spots. They have so many things to offer. We, as your credit union today, cannot offer you. And so expanded products and services, expanded locations, better electronic services, better remote deposit capture, all those types of things that we're, whether we like it or not, or kind of be forced upon us to make happen in our banking world today, they do it better than we do. And so that's a win. Just from a membership perspective, getting it done better is a win for us.
And a member sent a note along with her neighbor to read about the reasons she supports the merger, which will change the name of Southern Humboldt's credit union to Community First.
Hi, Jessica Muick, and still angered by the secrecy of the deal 5 years ago. And I'll be glad to have a different name other than the hated one I've avoided saying for 5 years.
Again, the Vocality meeting around the merger with Community First Credit Union will be at the Mateel next Wednesday, March 12th. The doors will open at 5:30 p.m. and the meeting will begin at 6. It is important to understand they cannot take ballots at the meeting. Members must mail them or vote electronically from the Vocality website before March 12th at 6 p.m. The letter on the Vocality website says paper ballots must be received by the third-party auditing firm no later than March 12th at 6 p.m. in order to be counted. And this is Kelly Lincoln reporting for KMUD News.
In state news, North Coast Congressman Jared Huffman was one of several House Democrats to walk out of Trump's speech mid-address. He shared his reasoning in this clip.
Hi, everyone. A little check-in the day after the State of the Union address. First of all, I know that many of you had passionate opinions in opposite directions about what I should do last night. Some thought I should be there and protest in certain ways or not protest. Others thought I should boycott. There's no perfect way to handle this because we've never seen a president abuse authority and flout the law and do all of these outrageous things the way Donald Trump does. But I decided to show up. I was part of a group of the Progressive Caucus that held signs to fact check Trump when he lied, which was almost constantly, and to express our displeasure in other ways. And while I tried to sit through the whole darn thing, by the time he got to crazy stuff about Greenland, I could take no more. My gag reflex overwhelmed me, and I had to leave the chamber. So here we are the day after, and we're trying to deal with the reality of a president who is completely off the rails and a Republican Congress who doesn't want to be a Congress. Stay tuned. I'll check in with more later.
In international news, Israel blocks aid into Gaza with hell plan to pressure agreement on new Israeli ceasefire plan. KPFA's Teresa Wersbianska and Rami Amaleri bring you this report.
The decision to block aid into Gaza during the holy month of Ramadan is more than a pressure campaign on the Islamist Hamas party to agree to Israel's new plan. It's affecting Gaza's population at large. Palestinians are calling it the, quote, hell plan, which also calls for another displacement of Palestinians from northern Gaza to southern Gaza. Here in western Gaza City, where a majority of the residents have returned to their homes just a few weeks ago during the ceasefire, many Palestinians reject the plan. Hanan Hashish is a mother of five children.
The situation is getting difficult, but after we experience displacement and we're deprived of many things, we can withstand any situation. So it'll be normal for me not to find certain items in the market.
Others in the same area are also vowing to defy Israeli plans to forcibly displace Palestinians from northern Gaza. Mohammed Albouri is a 60-year-old resident of northwestern Gaza City.
What should I say? Only praise be to God. I myself remain steadfast and was injured in the north, and I will never leave the area, whatever happens.
Over the past week, Israel has been demanding Hamas release all remaining Israeli hostages within the first phase of the ceasefire that came to an end over this past weekend. Meanwhile, mediation efforts by Egypt and Qatar are underway ahead of a scheduled visit by Donald Trump's envoy, Steve Witkoff, to the region. Salah Abdelati is a Gaza-based human rights activist. He is head of the Palestinian Committee for Defending the Palestinian People's Rights.
We condemn the repeated remarks either by the USA or the occupation state with respect to the hell plan to pressure the Palestinian people by preventing entry of humanitarian aid to the Strip. We also condemn the use of weapons to kill civilians and destroy residential homes. Such actions are considered to be war crimes for which Israel should be held accountable and sanctioned until it abides by international law.
Israel continues to attack Palestinians in Gaza, killing two today in Rafah with a drone strike and two others this past weekend. The Islamist Hamas party says it is ready to enter the second phase of the existing negotiated truce deal and that there is no need for an extension of phase one nor a new deal. Based on the provisions of the existing deal, Israel should complete its withdrawal from the Philadelphia corridor in southern Gaza and other populated areas of Gaza by this week. It has so far refused. For Pacifica Radio's Rami Almagari in Gaza, I'm Teresa Wersbianska.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Patricia Tinkler, and thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Sagir Bjarn, Kelly Lincoln, Teresa Wersbianska, and Rami Amaleri. KMUD News is online. You can find us on kmud.org, Instagram, and Facebook, and now streaming on most podcast platforms. That's where you can see related stories, links, and videos. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Reporting from the KMUD studio in Redway, I'm Lisa Music.